and Sawakari, a New Guinea lowlander from the north coast. Javans dominate the Indonesian government, which annexed western New Guinea in the 1960s and used bombs and machine guns to crush New Guinean opposition. Ahmad later decided to stay in town and to let me do the forest survey alone with Wiwar and Sawakari. He explained his decision to me by pointing to his straight, coarse hair, so unlike that of New Guineans, and saying that New Guineans would kill anyone with hair like his if they found him far from army backup. Ping Hwa had put away his newspaper because importation of Chinese writing is nominally illegal in Indonesian New Guinea. In much of Indonesia, the merchants are Chinese immigrants. Latent mutual fear between the economically dominant Chinese and politically dominant Javans erupted in 1966 in a bloody revolution, when Javans slaughtered hundreds of thousands of Chinese. As New Guineans, Wiwar and Sawakari shared most New Guineans' resentment of Javan dictatorship. But they also scorned each other's groups. Highlanders dismiss lowlanders as effete sago-eaters, while lowlanders dismiss highlanders as primitive big-heads, referring both to their massive coiled hair and to their reputation for arrogance. Within a few days of my setting up an isolated forest camp with Wiwar and Sawakari, they came close to fighting each other with axes. Tensions among the groups that Ahmad, Wiwar, Sawakari, and Ping Hwa represent dominate the politics of Indonesia, the world's fourth most populous nation. These modern tensions have roots going back thousands of years. When we think of major overseas population movements, we tend to focus on those since Columbus's discovery of the Americas, and on the resulting replacements of non-Europeans by Europeans within historic times. But there were also big overseas movements long before Columbus, and prehistoric replacements of non-European peoples by other non-European peoples. Wiwar, Ahmad, and Sawakari represent three prehistorical waves of people that moved overseas from the Asian mainland into the Pacific. Wiwar's highlanders are probably descended from an early wave that had colonized New Guinea from Asia by 40,000 years ago. Ahmad's ancestors arrived in Java, ultimately from the South China coast, around 4,000 years ago, completing the replacement there of people related to Wiwar's ancestors. Sawakari's ancestors reached New Guinea around 3,600 years ago as part of that same wave from the South China coast, while Ping Hwa's ancestors still occupy China. The population movement that brought Ahmad's and Sawakari's ancestors to Java and New Guinea, respectively, termed the Austronesian expansion, was among the biggest population movements of the last 6,000 years. One prong of it became the Polynesians, who populated the most remote islands of the Pacific and were the greatest seafarers among Neolithic peoples. Austronesian languages are spoken today as native languages over more than half of the globe's span, from Madagascar to Easter Island. In this book on human population movements since the end of the Ice Ages, the Austronesian expansion occupies a central place, as one of the most important phenomena to be explained. Why did Austronesian people, stemming ultimately from mainland China, colonize Java and the rest of Indonesia, and replace the original inhabitants there, instead of Indonesians colonizing China and replacing the Chinese? Having occupied all of Indonesia, why were the Austronesians then unable to occupy more than a narrow coastal strip of the New Guinea lowlands, and why were they completely unable to displace Wiwar's people from the New Guinea highlands? How did the descendants of Chinese immigrants become transformed into Polynesians? Today, the population of Java, most other Indonesian islands except the easternmost ones, and the Philippines is rather homogeneous. In appearance and genes, those islands' inhabitants are similar to South Chinese, and even more similar to tropical Southeast Asians, especially those of the Malay Peninsula. Their languages are equally homogeneous. While 374 languages are spoken in the Philippines and Western and Central Indonesia, all of them are closely related and fall within the same sub-subfamily, Western Malayo-Polynesian, of the Austronesian language family. Austronesian languages reached the Asian mainland on the Malay Peninsula and in small pockets in Vietnam and Cambodia, near the westernmost Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo. But they occur nowhere else on the mainland. Some Austronesian words borrowed into English include taboo and tattoo, from a Polynesian language, boondocks, from the Tagalog language of the Philippines, and amuk, batik, and orangutan, from Malay. That genetic and linguistic uniformity of Indonesia and the Philippines is initially as surprising as is the predominant linguistic uniformity of China. The famous Java Homo erectus fossils prove that humans have occupied at least Western Indonesia for a million years. That should have given ample time for humans to evolve genetic and linguistic diversity and tropical adaptations, such as dark skins like those of many other tropical peoples. But instead, Indonesians and Filipinos have light skins. It is also surprising that Indonesians and Filipinos are so similar to tropical Southeast Asians and South Chinese in other physical features besides light skins and in their genes. A glance at a map makes it obvious that Indonesia offered the only possible route by which humans could have reached New Guinea and Australia 40,000 years ago. So one might naively have expected modern Indonesians to be like modern New Guineans and Australians. In reality, there are only a few New Guinean-like populations in the Philippine-Western Indonesia area, notably the Negritos living in mountainous areas of the Philippines. As is also true of the three New Guinean-like relict populations that I mentioned in speaking of tropical Southeast Asia, the Philippine Negritos could be relicts of populations ancestral to Wiwar's people before they reached New Guinea. Even those Negritos speak Austronesian languages similar to those of their Filipino neighbors, implying that they too, like Malaysia's Semang Negritos and Africa's Pygmies, have lost their original language. All these facts suggest strongly that either tropical Southeast Asians or South Chinese speaking Austronesian languages recently spread through the Philippines and Indonesia, replacing all the former inhabitants of those islands except the Philippine Negritos, and replacing all the original island languages. That event evidently took place too recently for the colonists to evolve dark skins, distinct language families, or genetic distinctiveness or diversity. Their languages are, of course, much more numerous than the eight dominant Chinese languages of mainland China, but are no more diverse. The proliferation of many similar languages in the Philippines and Indonesia merely reflects the fact that the islands never underwent a political and cultural unification, as did China. Details of language distributions provide valuable clues to the root of this hypothesized Austronesian expansion. The whole Austronesian language family consists of 959 languages, divided among four subfamilies. But one of those subfamilies, termed Malayo-Polynesian, comprises 945 of those 959 languages and covers almost the entire geographic range of the Austronesian family. Before the recent overseas expansion of Europeans speaking Indo-European languages, Austronesian was the most widespread language family in the world. That suggests that the Malayo-Polynesian subfamily differentiated recently out of the Austronesian family and spread far from the Austronesian homeland, giving rise to many local languages, all of which are still closely related because there has been too little time to develop large linguistic differences. For the location of that Austronesian homeland, we should therefore look not to Malayo-Polynesian, but to the other three Austronesian subfamilies, which differ considerably more from each other and from Malayo-Polynesian than the sub-subfamilies of Malayo-Polynesian differ among each other. It turns out that those three other subfamilies have coincident distributions, all of them tiny compared with the distribution of Malayo-Polynesian. They are confined to aborigines of the island of Taiwan, lying only 90 miles from the South China mainland. Taiwan's aborigines had the island largely to themselves, until mainland Chinese began settling in large numbers within the last 1,000 years. Still more mainlanders arrived after 1945, especially after the Chinese communists defeated the Chinese nationalists in 1949, so that aborigines now constitute only 2% of Taiwan's population. The concentration of three out of the four Austronesian subfamilies on Taiwan suggests that, within the present Austronesian realm, Taiwan is the homeland where Austronesian languages have been spoken for the most millennia, and have consequently had the longest time in which to diverge. All other Austronesian languages from those on Madagascar to those on Easter Island, would then stem from a population expansion out of Taiwan. We can now turn to archaeological evidence. While the debris of ancient village sites does not include fossilized words along with bones and pottery, it does reveal movements of people and cultural artifacts that could be associated with languages. Like the rest of the world, most of the present Austronesian realm, Taiwan, the Philippines, Indonesia, and many Pacific islands, was originally occupied by hunter-gatherers, lacking pottery, polished stone tools, domestic animals, and crops. The sole exceptions to this generalization are the remote islands of Madagascar, eastern Melanesia, Polynesia, and Micronesia, which were never reached by hunter-gatherers and remained empty of humans until the Austronesian expansion. The first archaeological signs of something different within the Austronesian realm come from Taiwan. Beginning around the 4th millennium BC, polished stone tools and a distinctive decorated pottery style, so-called Tapin King pottery, derived from earlier South China mainland pottery, appeared on Taiwan and on the opposite coast of the South China mainland. Remains of rice and millet at later Taiwanese sites provide evidence of agriculture. Tapin King sites of Taiwan and the South China coast are full of fish bones and mollusk shells, as well as of stone net sinkers and adzes suitable for hollowing out a wooden canoe. Evidently, those first Neolithic occupants of Taiwan had watercraft adequate for deep-sea fishing and for regular sea traffic across Taiwan Strait, separating that island from the China coast. Thus, Taiwan Strait may have served as the training ground where mainland Chinese developed the open-water maritime skills that would permit them to expand over the Pacific. One specific type of artifact linking Taiwan's Tapin King culture to later Pacific Island cultures is a bark beater, a stone implement used for pounding the fibrous bark of certain tree species into rope, nets, and clothing. Once Pacific peoples spread beyond the range of wool-yielding domestic animals and fiber plant crops and hence of woven clothing, they became dependent on pounded bark cloth for their clothing. Inhabitants of Rennell Island, a traditional Polynesian island that did not become westernized until the 1930s, told me that westernization yielded the wonderful side benefit that the island became quiet. No more sounds of bark beaters everywhere, pounding out bark cloth from dawn until after dusk every day. Within a millennium or so after the Tapin King culture reached Taiwan, archaeological evidence shows that cultures obviously derived from it spread farther and farther from Taiwan to fill up the modern Austronesian realm. The evidence includes ground stone tools, pottery, bones of domestic pigs, and crop remains. For example, the decorated Tapin King pottery on Taiwan gave way to undecorated plain or red pottery, which has also been found at sites in the Philippines and on the Indonesian islands of Celebes and Timor. This cultural package of pottery, stone tools, and domesticates appeared around 3000 BC in the Philippines, around 2500 BC on the Indonesian islands of Celebes and North Borneo and Timor, around 2000 BC on Java and Sumatra, and around 1600 BC in the New Guinea region. There, as we shall see, the expansion assumed a speedboat pace as bearers of the cultural package raced eastward into the previously uninhabited Pacific Ocean beyond the Solomon Archipelago. The last phases of the expansion during the millennium after AD 1 resulted in the colonization of every Polynesian and Micronesian island capable of supporting humans. Astonishingly, it also swept westward across the Indian Ocean to the east coast of Africa, resulting in the colonization of the island of Madagascar. At least until the expansion reached coastal New Guinea, travel between islands was probably by double outrigger sailing canoes, which are still widespread throughout Indonesia today. That boat design represented a major advance over the simple dugout canoes prevalent among traditional peoples living on inland waterways throughout the world. A dugout canoe is just what its name implies, a solid tree trunk dug out, that is, hollowed out, and its ends shaped by an adze. Since the canoe is as round-bottomed as the trunk from which it was carved, the least imbalance in weight distribution tips the canoe toward the overweighted side. Whenever I've been paddled in dugouts up New Guinea rivers by New Guineans, I've spent much of the trip in terror. It seems that every slight movement of mine risked capsizing the canoe and spilling out me and my binoculars to commune with crocodiles. New Guineans manage to look secure while paddling dugouts on calm lakes and rivers, but not even New Guineans can use a dugout in seas with modest waves. Hence, some stabilizing device must have been essential not only for the Austronesian expansion through Indonesia, but even for the initial colonization of Taiwan. The solution was to lash two smaller logs, outriggers, parallel to the hull and several feet from it, one on each side, connected to the hull by poles lashed perpendicular to the hull and outriggers. Whenever the hull starts to tip toward one side, the buoyancy of the outrigger on that side prevents the outrigger from being pushed under the water, and hence makes it virtually impossible to capsize the vessel. The invention of the double outrigger sailing canoe may have been the technological breakthrough that triggered the Austronesian expansion from the Chinese mainland. Two striking coincidences between archaeological and linguistic evidence support the inference that the people bringing a Neolithic culture to Taiwan, the Philippines, and Indonesia thousands of years ago spoke Austronesian languages and were ancestral to the Austronesian speakers still inhabiting those islands today. First, both types of evidence point unequivocally to the colonization of Taiwan as the first stage of the expansion from the South China coast, and to the colonization of the Philippines and Indonesia from Taiwan as the next stage. If the expansion had proceeded from tropical Southeast Asia's Malay Peninsula to the nearest Indonesian island of Sumatra, then to other Indonesian islands, and finally to the Philippines and Taiwan, we would find the deepest divisions, reflecting the greatest time depth, of the Austronesian language family among the modern languages of the Malay Peninsula and Sumatra, and the languages of Taiwan and the Philippines would have differentiated only recently within a single subfamily. Instead, the deepest divisions are in Taiwan, and the languages of the Malay Peninsula and Sumatra fall together in the same sub-sub-subfamily, a recent branch of the Western Malayo-Polynesian sub-subfamily, which is in turn a fairly recent branch of the Malayo-Polynesian subfamily. Those details of linguistic relationships agree perfectly with the archaeological evidence that the colonization of the Malay Peninsula was recent and followed rather than preceded the colonization of Taiwan, the Philippines, and Indonesia. The other coincidence between archaeological and linguistic evidence concerns the cultural baggage that ancient Austronesians used. Archaeology provides us with direct evidence of culture in the form of pottery, pig and fish bones, and so on. One might initially wonder how a linguist, studying only modern languages whose unwritten ancestral forms remain unknown, could ever figure out whether Austronesians living on Taiwan 6,000 years ago had pigs. The solution is to reconstruct the vocabularies of vanished ancient languages, so-called proto-languages, by comparing vocabularies of modern languages derived from them. For instance, the words meaning sheep in many languages of the Indo-European language family distributed from Ireland to India are quite similar. Avis, avis, ovis, oveja, ovca, ovis, and oi in Lithuanian, Sanskrit, Latin, Spanish, Russian, Greek, and Irish, respectively. The English sheep is obviously from a different root, but English retains the original root in the word you. Comparison of the sound shifts that the various modern Indo-European languages have undergone during their histories suggests that the original form was always in the ancestral Indo-European language spoken around 6,000 years ago. That unwritten ancestral language is termed Proto-Indo-European. Evidently, Proto-Indo-Europeans 6,000 years ago had sheep in agreement with archaeological evidence. Nearly 2,000 other words of their vocabulary can similarly be reconstructed, including words for goat, horse, wheel, brother, and eye. But no Proto-Indo-European word can be reconstructed for gun, which uses different roots in different modern Indo-European languages, gun in English, fusil in French, rougeau in Russian, and so on. That shouldn't surprise us. People 6,000 years ago couldn't possibly have had a word for guns, which were invented only within the past 1,000 years. Since there was thus no inherited shared root meaning gun, each Indo-European language had to invent or borrow its own word when guns were finally invented. Proceeding in the same way, we can compare modern Taiwanese, Philippine, Indonesian, and Polynesian languages to reconstruct a Proto-Austronesian language spoken in the distant past. To no one's surprise, that reconstructed Proto-Austronesian language had words with meanings such as to, bird, ear, and head louse. Of course, Proto-Austronesians could count to two, knew of birds, and had ears and lice. More interestingly, the reconstructed language had words for pig, dog, and rice, which must therefore have been part of Proto-Austronesian culture. The reconstructed language is full of words indicating a maritime economy, such as outrigger canoe, sail, giant clam, octopus, fish trap, and sea turtle. This linguistic evidence regarding the culture of Proto-Austronesians, wherever and whenever they lived, agrees well with the archaeological evidence regarding the pottery-making, sea-oriented, food-producing people living on Taiwan around 6,000 years ago. The same procedure can be applied to reconstruct Proto-Malayo-Polynesian, the ancestral language spoken by Austronesians after emigrating from Taiwan. Proto-Malayo-Polynesian contains words for many tropical crops like taro, breadfruit, bananas, yams, and coconuts, for which no word can be reconstructed in Proto-Austronesian. Thus, the linguistic evidence suggests that many tropical crops were added to the Austronesian repertoire after the emigration from Taiwan. This conclusion agrees with archaeological evidence, as colonizing farmers spread southward from Taiwan, lying about 23 degrees north of the equator, toward the equatorial tropics. They came to depend increasingly on tropical root and tree crops, which they proceeded to carry with them out into the tropical Pacific. How could those Austronesian-speaking farmers from South China via Taiwan replace the original hunter-gatherer population of the Philippines and western Indonesia so completely that little genetic and no linguistic evidence of that original population survived? The reasons resemble the reasons why Europeans replaced or exterminated native Australians within the last two centuries, and why South Chinese replaced the original tropical Southeast Asians earlier. The farmers' much denser populations, superior tools and weapons, more developed watercraft and maritime skills, and epidemic diseases to which the farmers but not the hunter-gatherers had some resistance. On the Asian mainland, Austronesian-speaking farmers were able similarly to replace some of the former hunter-gatherers of the Malay Peninsula, because Austronesians colonized the peninsula from the south and east, from the Indonesian islands of Sumatra and Borneo, around the same time that Austroasiatic-speaking farmers were colonizing the peninsula from the north, from Thailand. Other Austronesians managed to establish themselves in parts of southern Vietnam and Cambodia to become the ancestors of the modern Chamic minority of those countries. However, Austronesian farmers could spread no farther into the Southeast Asian mainland because Austroasiatic and Thai Kadai farmers had already replaced the former hunter-gatherers there, and because Austronesian farmers had no advantage over Austroasiatic and Thai Kadai farmers. Although we infer that Austronesian speakers originated from coastal South China, Austronesian languages today are not spoken anywhere in mainland China, possibly because they were among the hundreds of former Chinese languages eliminated by the southward expansion of Sino-Tibetan speakers. But the language families closest to Austronesian are thought to be Thai Kadai, Austroasiatic, and Miao Yao. Thus, while Austronesian languages in China may not have survived the onslaught of Chinese dynasties, some of their sister and cousin languages did. We have now followed the initial stages of the Austronesian expansion for 2,500 miles from the South China coast through Taiwan and the Philippines to western and central Indonesia. In the course of that expansion, Austronesians came to occupy all habitable areas of those islands, from the seacoast to the interior, and from the lowlands to the mountains. By 1500 BC, their familiar archaeological hallmarks, including pig bones and plain red-slipped pottery, showed that they had reached the eastern Indonesian island of Halmahera, less than 200 miles from the western end of the big mountainous island of New Guinea. Did they proceed to overrun that island, just as they had already overrun the big mountainous islands of Celebes, Borneo, Java, and Sumatra? They did not, as a glance at the faces of most modern New Guineans makes obvious, and as detailed studies of New Guinean genes confirm. My friend Wiwar and all other New Guinea Highlanders differ obviously from Indonesians, Filipinos, and South Chinese in their dark skins, tightly coiled hair, and face shapes. Most lowlanders from New Guinea's interior and south coast resemble the highlanders except that they tend to be taller. Geneticists have failed to find characteristic Austronesian gene markers in blood samples from New Guinea highlanders. But peoples of New Guinea's north and east coasts and of the Bismarck and Solomon archipelagos north and south of New Guinea present a more complex picture. In appearance, they are variably intermediate between highlanders like Wiwar and Indonesians like Akmad, though on the average considerably closer to Wiwar. For instance, my friend Sawakari from the north coast has wavy hair intermediate between Akmad's straight hair and Wiwar's coiled hair, and skin somewhat paler than Wiwar's, though considerably darker than Akmad's. Genetically, the Bismarck and Solomon Islanders and north coastal New Guineans are about 15% Austronesian and 85% like New Guinea Highlanders. Hence, Austronesians evidently reached the New Guinea region but failed completely to penetrate the island's interior and were genetically diluted by New Guinea's previous residents on the north coast and islands. Modern languages tell essentially the same story but add detail. In Chapter 15, I explained that most New Guinea languages, termed Papuan languages, are unrelated to any language families elsewhere in the world. Without exception, every language spoken in the New Guinea mountains, the whole of southwestern and south-central lowland New Guinea, including the coast, and the interior of northern New Guinea, is a Papuan language. But Austronesian languages are spoken in a narrow strip immediately on the north and southeast coasts. Most languages of the Bismarck and Solomon Islands are Austronesian. Papuan languages are spoken only in isolated pockets on a few islands. Austronesian languages spoken in the Bismarcks and Solomons and north coastal New Guinea are related, as a separate sub-sub-subfamily termed Oceanic, to the sub-sub-subfamily of languages spoken on Halmahera and the west end of New Guinea. That linguistic relationship confirms, as one would expect from a map, that Austronesian speakers of the New Guinea region arrived by way of Halmahera. Details of Austronesian and Papuan languages and their distributions in North New Guinea testify to long contact between the Austronesian invaders and the Papuan-speaking residents. Both the Austronesian and the Papuan languages of the region show massive influences of each other's vocabularies and grammars, making it difficult to decide whether certain languages are basically Austronesian languages influenced by Papuan ones, or the reverse. As one travels from village to village along the north coast or its fringing islands, one passes from a village with an Austronesian language to a village with a Papuan language, and then to another Austronesian-speaking language, without any genetic discontinuity at the linguistic boundaries. All this suggests that descendants of Austronesian invaders and of original New Guineans have been trading, intermarrying, and acquiring each other's genes and languages for several thousand years on the North New Guinea coast and its islands. That long contact transferred Austronesian languages more effectively than Austronesian genes, with the result that most Bismarck and Solomon Islanders now speak Austronesian languages, even though their appearance and most of their genes are still Papuan. But neither the genes nor the languages of the Austronesians penetrated New Guinea's interior. The outcome of their invasion of New Guinea was thus very different from the outcome of their invasion of Borneo, Celebes, and other big Indonesian islands, where their steamroller eliminated almost all traces of the previous inhabitants' genes and languages. To understand what happened in New Guinea, let us now turn to the evidence from archaeology. Around 1600 BC, almost simultaneously with their appearance on Halmahera, the familiar archaeological hallmarks of the Austronesian expansion, pigs, chickens, dogs, red-slipped pottery, and adzes of ground stone, and of giant clamshells, appear in the New Guinea region. But two features distinguish the Austronesians' arrival there from their earlier arrival in the Philippines and Indonesia. The first feature consists of pottery designs, which are aesthetic features of no economic significance, but which do let archaeologists immediately recognize an early Austronesian site. Whereas most early Austronesian pottery in the Philippines and Indonesia was undecorated, pottery in the New Guinea region was finely decorated with geometric designs arranged in horizontal bands. In other respects, the pottery preserved the red slip and the vessel forms characteristic of earlier Austronesian pottery in Indonesia. Evidently, Austronesian settlers in the New Guinea region got the idea of tattooing their pots, perhaps inspired by geometric designs that they had already been using on their bark cloth and body tattoos. This style is termed Lapita pottery, after an archaeological site named Lapita, where it was described. The much more significant distinguishing feature of early Austronesian sites in the New Guinea region is their distribution. In contrast to those in the Philippines and Indonesia, where even the earliest known Austronesian sites are on big islands like Luzon and Borneo and Celebes, sites with Lapita pottery in the New Guinea region are virtually confined to small islets fringing remote larger islands. To date, Lapita pottery has been found at only one site, Aitape, on the north coast of New Guinea itself, and at a couple of sites in the Solomons. Most Lapita sites of the New Guinea region are in the Bismarcks, on islets off the coast of the larger Bismarck Islands, occasionally on the coasts of the larger islands themselves. Since, as we shall see, the makers of Lapita pottery were capable of sailing thousands of miles, their failure to transfer their villages a few miles to the large Bismarck Islands or a few dozen miles to New Guinea was certainly not due to inability to get there. The basis of Lapita subsistence can be reconstructed from the garbage excavated by archaeologists at Lapita sites. Lapita people depended heavily on seafood, including fish, porpoises, sea turtles, sharks, and shellfish. They had pigs, chickens, and dogs, and ate the nuts of many trees, including coconuts. While they probably also ate the usual Austronesian root crops, such as taro and yams, evidence of those crops is hard to obtain, because hard nut shells are much more likely than soft roots to persist for thousands of years in garbage heaps. Naturally, it is impossible to prove directly that the people who made Lapita pots spoke an Austronesian language. However, two facts make this inference virtually certain. First, except for the decorations on the pots themselves and their associated cultural paraphernalia are similar to the cultural remains found at Indonesian and Philippine sites ancestral to modern Austronesian-speaking societies. Second, Lapita pottery also appears on remote Pacific islands with no previous human inhabitants, with no evidence of a major second wave of settlement subsequent to that bringing Lapita pots, and where the modern inhabitants speak an Austronesian language. Hence, Lapita pottery may be safely assumed to mark Austronesians' arrival in the New Guinea region. What were those Austronesian pot makers doing on islets adjacent to bigger islands? They were probably living in the same way as modern potmakers lived until recently on islets in the New Guinea region. In 1972, I visited such a village on Malay Island, in the Siasi Island group off the medium-sized island of Umboy, off the larger Bismarck Island of New Britain. When I stepped ashore on Malay in search of birds, knowing nothing about the people there, I was astonished by the sight that greeted me. Instead of the usual village of low huts surrounded by large gardens sufficient to feed the village and with a few canoes drawn up on the beach, most of the area of Malay was occupied by two-story wooden houses side by side, leaving no ground available for gardens, the New Guinea equivalent of downtown Manhattan. On the beach were rows of big canoes. It turned out that Malay islanders, besides being fishermen, were also specialized potters, carvers, and traders, who lived by making beautifully decorated pots and wooden bowls, transporting them in their canoes to larger islands, and exchanging their wares for pigs, dogs, vegetables, and other necessities. Even the timber for Malay canoes was obtained by trade from villagers on nearby Umboy Island, since Malay does not have trees big enough to be fashioned into canoes. In the days before European shipping, trade between islands in the New Guinea region was monopolized by such specialized groups of canoe-building potters skilled in sailing without navigational instruments, and living on offshore islets or occasionally in mainland coastal villages. By the time I reached Malai in 1972, those indigenous trade networks had collapsed or contracted, partly because of competition from European motor vessels and aluminum pots, partly because the Australian colonial government forbade long-distance canoe voyaging after some accidents in which traders were drowned. I would guess that the Lapita potters were the inter-island traders of the New Guinea region in the centuries after 1600 BC. The spread of Austronesian languages to the north coast of New Guinea itself, and over even the largest Bismarck and Solomon Islands, must have occurred mostly after Lapita times, since Lapita sites themselves were concentrated on Bismarck Islands. Not until around AD 1 did pottery derived from the Lapita style appear on the south side of New Guinea's southeast peninsula. When Europeans began exploring New Guinea in the late 19th century, all the remainder of New Guinea's south coast still supported populations only of Papuan language speakers, even though Austronesian-speaking populations were established not only on the southeastern peninsula, but also on the Aru and Kei Islands, lying 70 to 80 miles off western New Guinea's south coast. Austronesians thus had thousands of years in which to colonize New Guinea's interior and its southern coast from nearby bases, but they never did so. Even their colonization of North New Guinea's coastal fringe was more linguistic than genetic. All northern coastal peoples remained predominantly New Guineans in their genes. At most, some of them merely adopted Austronesian languages, possibly in order to communicate with the long-distance traders who linked societies. Thus, the outcome of the Austronesian expansion in the New Guinea region was opposite to that in Indonesia and the Philippines. In the latter region, the indigenous population disappeared, presumably driven off, killed, infected, or assimilated by the invaders. In the former region, the indigenous population mostly kept the invaders out. The invaders, the Austronesians, were the same in both cases, and the indigenous populations may also have been genetically similar to each other. If the original Indonesian population supplanted by Austronesians really was related to New Guineans, as I suggested earlier, why the opposite outcomes? The answer becomes obvious when one considers the differing cultural circumstances of Indonesia's and New Guinea's indigenous populations. Before Austronesians arrived, most of Indonesia was thinly occupied by hunter-gatherers lacking even polished stone tools. In contrast, food production had already been established for thousands of years in the New Guinea highlands, and probably in the New Guinea lowlands and in the Bismarcks and Solomons as well. The New Guinea highlands supported some of the densest populations of Stone Age people anywhere in the modern world. Austronesians enjoyed few advantages in competing with those established New Guinean populations. Some of the crops on which Austronesians subsisted, such as taro, yams, and bananas, had probably already been independently domesticated in New Guinea before Austronesians arrived. The New Guineans readily integrated Austronesian chickens, dogs, and especially pigs into their food-producing economies. New Guineans already had polished stone tools. They were at least as resistant to tropical diseases as were Austronesians because they carried the same five types of genetic protections against malaria as did Austronesians, and some or all of those genes evolved independently in New Guinea. New Guineans were already accomplished seafarers, although not as accomplished as the makers of Lapita pottery. Tens of thousands of years before the arrival of Austronesians, New Guineans had colonized the Bismarck and Solomon archipelagos, and a trade in obsidian, a volcanic stone suitable for making sharp tools, was thriving in the Bismarcks at least 18,000 years before the Austronesians arrived. New Guineans even seem to have expanded recently westward against the Austronesian tide into eastern Indonesia, where languages spoken on the islands of North Halmahera and of Timor are typical Papuan languages related to some languages of western New Guinea. In short, the variable outcomes of the Austronesian expansion strikingly illustrate the role of food production in human population movements. Austronesian food producers migrated into two regions, New Guinea and Indonesia, occupied by resident peoples who were probably related to each other. The residents of Indonesia were still hunter-gatherers, while the residents of New Guinea were already food producers and had developed many of the concomitants of food production, dense populations, disease resistance, more advanced technology, and so on. As a result, while the Austronesian expansion swept away the original Indonesians, it failed to make much headway in the New Guinea region, just as it also failed to make headway against Austroasiatic and Thai Kadai food producers in tropical Southeast Asia. We have now traced the Austronesian expansion through Indonesia and up to the shores of New Guinea and tropical Southeast Asia. In Chapter 19, we shall trace it across the Indian Ocean to Madagascar, while in Chapter 15, we saw that ecological difficulties kept Austronesians from establishing themselves in northern and western Australia. The expansion's remaining thrust began when the Lapita potters sailed far eastward into the Pacific beyond the Solomons, into an island realm that no other humans had reached previously. Around 1200 BC, Lapita potsherds, the familiar triumvirate of pigs and chickens and dogs, and the usual other archaeological hallmarks of Austronesians appeared on the Pacific archipelagos of Fiji, Samoa, and Tonga, over 1,000 miles east of the Solomons. Early in the Christian era, most of those same hallmarks, with the notable exception of pottery, appeared on the islands of eastern Polynesia, including the Societes and Marquesas. Further long overwater canoe voyages brought settlers north to Hawaii, east to Pitcairn and eastern islands, and southwest to New Zealand. The native inhabitants of most of those islands today are the Polynesians, who thus are the direct descendants of the Lapita potters. They speak Austronesian languages closely related to those of the New Guinea region, and their main crops are the Austronesian package that included taro, yams, bananas, coconuts, and breadfruit. With the occupation of the Chatham Islands off New Zealand around AD 1400, barely a century before European explorers entered the Pacific, the task of exploring the Pacific was finally completed by Asians. Their tradition of exploration, lasting tens of thousands of years, had begun when Wiwar's ancestors spread through Indonesia to New Guinea and Australia. It ended only when it had run out of targets and almost every habitable Pacific island had been occupied. To anyone interested in world history, human societies of East Asia and the Pacific are instructive because they provide so many examples of how environment molds history. Depending on their geographic homeland, East Asian and Pacific peoples differed in their access to domesticable wild plant and animal species and in their connectedness to other peoples. Again and again, people with access to the prerequisites for food production and with a location favoring diffusion of technology from elsewhere replaced peoples lacking these advantages. Again and again, when a single wave of colonists spread out over diverse environments, their descendants developed in separate ways, depending on those environmental differences. For instance, we have seen that South Chinese developed indigenous food production and technology, received writing and still more technology and political structures from North China, and went on to colonize tropical Southeast Asia and Taiwan, largely replacing the former inhabitants of those areas. Within Southeast Asia, among the descendants or relatives of those food-producing South Chinese colonists, the Yumbri in the mountain rainforests of northeastern Thailand and Laos reverted to living as hunter-gatherers, while the Yumbri's close relatives, the Vietnamese, speaking a language in the same sub-subfamily of Austroasiatic as the Yumbri language, remained food producers in the rich Red Delta and established a vast metal-based empire. Similarly, among Austronesian emigrant farmers from Taiwan and Indonesia, the Punan in the rainforests of Borneo were forced to turn back to the hunter-gatherer lifestyle, while their relatives living on Java's rich volcanic soils remained food producers, founded a kingdom under the influence of India, adopted writing, and built the great Buddhist monument at Borobudur. The Austronesians, who went on to colonize Polynesia, became isolated from East Asian metallurgy and writing, and hence remained without writing or metal. As we saw in Chapter 2, though, Polynesian political and social organization and economies underwent great diversification in different environments. Within a millennium, East Polynesian colonists had reverted to hunting-gathering on the Chathams while building a proto-state with intensive food production on Hawaii. When Europeans at last arrived, their technological and other advantages enabled them to establish temporary colonial domination over most of tropical Southeast Asia and the Pacific Islands. However, indigenous germs and food producers prevented Europeans from settling most of this region in significant numbers. Within this area, only New Zealand, New Caledonia, and Hawaii, the largest and most remote islands, lying farthest from the equator and hence in the most nearly temperate Europe-like climates, now support large European populations. Thus, unlike Australia and the Americas, East Asia and most Pacific islands remain occupied by East Asian and Pacific peoples. Chapter 18, Hemispheres Colliding. The largest population replacement of the last 13,000 years has been the one resulting from the recent collision between Old World and New World societies. Its most dramatic and decisive moment, as we saw in Chapter 3, occurred when Pizarro's tiny army of Spaniards captured the Inca Emperor Atahualpa, absolute ruler of the largest, richest, most populous, and administratively and technologically most advanced Native American state. Atahualpa's capture symbolizes the European conquest of the Americas, because the same mix of proximate factors that caused it was also responsible for European conquests of other Native American societies. Let us now return to that collision of hemispheres, applying what we have learned since Chapter 3. The basic question to be answered is, why did Europeans reach and conquer the lands of Native Americans, instead of vice versa? Our starting point will be a comparison of Eurasian and Native American societies as of AD 1492, the year of Columbus's discovery of the Americas. Our comparison begins with food production, a major determinant of local population size and societal complexity, hence an ultimate factor behind the conquest. The most glaring difference between American and Eurasian food production involved big domestic mammal species. In Chapter 9, we encountered Eurasia's 13 species, which became its chief source of animal protein, meat and milk, wool and hides, its main mode of land transport of people and goods, its indispensable vehicles of warfare, and, by drawing plows and providing manure, a big enhancer of crop production. Until water wheels and windmills began to replace Eurasia's mammals in medieval times, they were also the major source of its industrial power beyond human muscle power, for example, for turning grindstones and operating water lifts. In contrast, the Americas had only one species of big domestic mammal, the llama alpaca, confined to a small area of the Andes and the adjacent Peruvian coast. While it was used for meat, wool, hides, and goods transport, it never yielded milk for human consumption, never bore a rider, never pulled a cart or a plow, and never served as a power source or vehicle of warfare. That's an enormous set of differences between Eurasian and Native American societies, due largely to the late Pleistocene extinction, extermination, of most of North and South America's former big wild mammal species. If it had not been for those extinctions, modern history might have taken a different course. When Cortes and his bedraggled adventurers landed on the Mexican coast in 1519, they might have been driven into the sea by thousands of Aztec cavalry mounted on domesticated Native American horses. Instead of the Aztecs dying of smallpox, the Spaniards might have been wiped out by American germs transmitted by disease-resistant Aztecs. American civilizations resting on animal power might have been sending their own conquistadores to ravage Europe, but those hypothetical outcomes were foreclosed by mammal extinctions thousands of years earlier. Those extinctions left Eurasia with many more wild candidates for domestication than the Americas offered. Most candidates disqualify themselves as potential domesticates for any of half a dozen reasons. Hence, Eurasia ended up with its 13 species of big domestic mammals, and the Americas with just its one very local species. Both hemispheres also had domesticated species of birds and small mammals, the turkey, guinea pig, and Muscovy duck very locally, and the dog more widely in the Americas. Chicken, geese, ducks, cats, dogs, rabbits, honeybees, silkworms, and some others in Eurasia. But the significance of all those species of small domestic animals was trivial compared with that of the big ones. Eurasia and the Americas also differed with respect to plant food production, though the disparity here was less marked than for animal food production. In 1492, agriculture was widespread in Eurasia, Among the few Eurasian hunter-gatherers lacking both crops and domestic animals were the Ainu of northern Japan, Siberian societies without reindeer, and small hunter-gatherer groups scattered through the forests of India and tropical Southeast Asia and trading with neighboring farmers. Some other Eurasian societies, notably the Central Asian pastoralists and the reindeer-herding Lapps and Samoyeds of the Arctic, had domestic animals but little or no agriculture. Virtually all other Eurasian societies engaged in agriculture as well as in herding animals. Agriculture was also widespread in the Americas, but hunter-gatherers occupied a larger fraction of the Americas' area than of Eurasia's. Those regions of the Americas without food production included all of northern North America and southern South America, the Canadian Great Plains, and all of western North America, except for small areas of the U.S. Southwest that supported irrigation agriculture. It is striking that the areas of Native America without food production included what today, after Europeans' arrival, are some of the most productive farmlands and pastures of both North and South America, the Pacific States of the United States, Canada's Wheat Belt, the Pampas of Argentina, and the Mediterranean zone of Chile. The former absence of food production in these lands was due entirely to their local paucity of domesticable wild animals and plants, and to geographic and ecological barriers that prevented the crops and the few domestic animal species of other parts of the Americas from arriving. Those lands became productive not only for European settlers, but also, in some cases, for Native Americans, as soon as Europeans introduced suitable domestic animals and crops. For instance, Native American societies became renowned for their mastery of horses, and in some cases of cattle and sheep herding, in parts of the Great Plains, the western United States, and the Argentine Pampas. Those mounted plains warriors and Navajo sheep herders and weavers now figure prominently in white Americans' image of American Indians, but the basis for that image was created only after 1492. These examples demonstrate that the sole missing ingredients required to sustain food production in large areas of the Americas were domestic animals and crops themselves. In those parts of the Americas that did support Native American agriculture, it was constrained by five major disadvantages, vis-à-vis Eurasian agriculture, widespread dependence on protein-poor corn instead of Eurasia's diverse and protein-rich cereals, hand planting of individual seeds instead of broadcast sowing, tilling by hand instead of plowing by animals, which enables one person to cultivate a much larger area, and which also permits cultivation of some fertile but tough soils and sods that are difficult to till by hand, such as those of the North American Great Plains, lack of animal manuring to increase soil fertility, and just human muscle power instead of animal power for agricultural tasks such as threshing, grinding, and irrigation. These differences suggest that Eurasian agriculture as of 1492 may have yielded on the average more calories and protein per person hour of labor than Native American agriculture did. Such differences in food production constituted a major ultimate cause of the disparities between Eurasian and Native American societies. Among the resulting proximate factors behind the conquest, the most important included differences in germs, technology, political organization, and writing. Of these, the one linked most directly to the differences in food production was germs. The infectious diseases that regularly visited crowded Eurasian societies, and to which many Eurasians consequently developed immune or genetic resistance, included all of history's most lethal killers: smallpox, measles, influenza, plague, tuberculosis, typhus, cholera, malaria, and others. Against that grim list, the sole crowd infectious diseases that can be attributed with certainty to pre-Columbian Native American societies were non-syphilitic treponemas. As I explained in Chapter 11, it remains uncertain whether syphilis arose in Eurasia or in the Americas, and the claim that human tuberculosis was present in the Americas before Columbus is, in my opinion, unproven. This continental difference in harmful germs resulted paradoxically from the difference in useful livestock. Most of the microbes responsible for the infectious diseases of crowded human societies evolved from very similar ancestral microbes, causing infectious diseases of the domestic animals with which food producers began coming into daily close contact around 10,000 years ago. Eurasia harbored many domestic animal species and hence developed many such microbes, while the Americas had very few of each. Other reasons why Native American societies evolved so few lethal microbes were that villages, which provided ideal breeding grounds for epidemic diseases, arose thousands of years later in the Americas than in Eurasia, and that the three regions of the New World supporting urban societies, the Andes, Mesoamerica, and the U.S. Southeast, were never connected by fast, high-volume trade on the scale that brought plague, influenza, and possibly smallpox to Europe from Asia. As a result, even malaria and yellow fever, the infectious diseases that eventually became major obstacles to European colonization of the American tropics, and that posed the biggest barrier to the construction of the Panama Canal, are not American diseases at all, but are caused by microbes of Old World tropical origin introduced to the Americas by Europeans. Rivaling germs as proximate factors behind Europe's conquest of the Americas were the differences in all aspects of technology. These differences stemmed ultimately from Eurasia's much longer history of densely populated, economically specialized, politically centralized, interacting and competing societies dependent on food production. Five areas of technology may be singled out. First, metals, initially copper, then bronze, and finally iron, were used for tools in all complex Eurasian societies as of 1492. In contrast, although copper, silver, gold, and alloys were used for ornaments in the Andes and some other parts of the Americas, stone and wood and bone were still the principal materials for tools in all Native American societies, which made only limited local use of copper tools. Second, military technology was far more potent in Eurasia than in the Americas. European weapons were steel swords, lances, and daggers, supplemented by small firearms and artillery, while body armor and helmets were also made of solid steel or else of chain mail. In place of steel, Native Americans used clubs and axes of stone or wood, occasionally copper in the Andes, slings, bows and arrows, and quilted armor, constituting much less effective protection and weaponry. In addition, Native American armies had no animals to oppose to horses, whose value for assaults and fast transport gave Europeans an overwhelming advantage until some Native American societies themselves adopted them. Third, Eurasian societies enjoyed a huge advantage in their sources of power to operate machines. The earliest advance over human muscle was the use of animals, cattle, horses, and donkeys, to pull plows and to turn wheels for grinding grain, raising water, and irrigating or draining fields. Water wheels appeared in Roman times and then proliferated, along with tidal mills and windmills in the Middle Ages. Coupled to systems of geared wheels, those engines harnessing water and wind power were used not only to grind grain and move water, but also to serve myriad manufacturing purposes, including crushing sugar, driving blast furnace bellows, grinding ores, making paper, polishing stone, pressing oil, producing salt, producing textiles, and sawing wood. It is conventional to define the Industrial Revolution arbitrarily as beginning with the harnessing of steam power in 18th century England. But in fact, an Industrial Revolution based on water and wind power had begun already in medieval times in many parts of Europe. As of 1492, all of those operations to which animal, water, and wind power were being applied in Eurasia were still being carried out by human muscle power in the Americas. Long before the wheel began to be used in power conversion in Eurasia, it had become the basis of most Eurasian land transport, not only for animal-drawn vehicles, but also for human-powered wheelbarrows, which enabled one or more people, still using just human muscle power, to transport much greater weights than they could have otherwise. Wheels were also adopted in Eurasian pottery making and in clocks. None of those uses of the wheel was adopted in the Americas, where wheels are attested only in Mexican ceramic toys. The remaining area of technology to be mentioned is sea transport. Many Eurasian societies developed large sailing ships, some of them capable of sailing against the wind and crossing the ocean, equipped with sextants, magnetic compasses, sternpost rudders, and cannons. In capacity, speed, maneuverability, and seaworthiness, those Eurasian ships were far superior to the rafts that carried out trade between the New World's most advanced societies, those of the Andes and Mesoamerica. Those rafts sailed with the wind along the Pacific coast. Pizarro's ship easily ran down and captured such a raft on his first voyage toward Peru. In addition to their germs and technology, Eurasian and Native American societies differed in their political organization. By late medieval or Renaissance times, most of Eurasia had come under the rule of organized states. Among these, the Habsburg, Ottoman, and Chinese states, the Mughal state of India, and the Mongol state at its peak in the 13th century, started out as large polyglot amalgamations formed by the conquest of other states. For that reason, they are generally referred to as empires. Many Eurasian states and empires had official religions that contributed to state cohesion, being invoked to legitimize the political leadership and to sanction wars against other peoples. Tribal and band societies in Eurasia were largely confined to the Arctic reindeer herders, the Siberian hunter-gatherers, and the hunter-gatherer enclaves in the Indian subcontinent and tropical Southeast Asia. The Americas had two empires, those of the Aztecs and Incas, which resembled their Eurasian counterparts in size, population, polyglot makeup, official religions, and origins in the conquest of smaller states. In the Americas, those were the sole two political units capable of mobilizing resources for public works or war on the scale of many Eurasian states, whereas seven European states, Spain, Portugal, England, France, Holland, Sweden, and Denmark, had the resources to acquire American colonies between 1492 and 1666. The Americas also held many chiefdoms, some of them virtually small states, in tropical South America, Mesoamerica beyond Aztec rule, and the U.S. Southeast. The rest of the Americas was organized only at the tribal or band level. The last proximate factor to be discussed is writing. Most Eurasian states had literate bureaucracies, and in some, a significant fraction of the populace, other than bureaucrats, was also literate. Writing empowered European societies by facilitating political administration and economic exchanges, motivating and guiding exploration and conquest, and making available a range of information and human experience extending into remote places and times. In contrast, use of writing in the Americas was confined to the elite in a small area of Mesoamerica. The Inca Empire employed an accounting system and mnemonic device based on knots termed quipu, but it could not have approached writing as a vehicle for transmitting detailed information. Thus, Eurasian societies in the time of Columbus enjoyed big advantages over Native American societies in food production, germs, technology, including weapons, political organization, and writing. These were the main factors tipping the outcome of the post-Columbian collisions. But those differences, as of AD 1492, represent just one snapshot of historical trajectories that had extended over at least 13,000 years in the Americas, and over a much longer time in Eurasia. For the Americas, in particular, the 1492 snapshot captures the end of the independent trajectory of Native Americans. Let us now trace out the earlier stages of those trajectories. The following is a table summarizing approximate dates of the appearance of key developments in the main homelands of each hemisphere, the Fertile Crescent and China in Eurasia, the Andes and Amazonia, and Mesoamerica in the Americas. It also includes the trajectory for the minor New World homeland of the eastern United States, and that for England, which is not a homeland at all, but is listed to illustrate how rapidly developments spread from the Fertile Crescent. Plant domestication arrived in the Fertile Crescent by 8500 BC, by 7500 BC in China, by 3500 BC in England, by 3000 BC in the Andes, 3000 BC in Amazonia, 3000 BC in Mesoamerica, and 2500 BC in the eastern U.S. Animal domestication arrived in the Fertile Crescent in 8000 BC, in China by 7500 BC, in England by 3500 BC, in the Andes by 3500 BC, It's an unknown factor in Amazonia, in Mesoamerica by 500 BC, and it's an unknown factor also in the eastern United States. Pottery arrived in the Fertile Crescent by 7,000 BC, by 7,500 BC in China, by 3,500 BC in England, between 3,100 and 1,800 BC in the Andes, 6,000 BC in Amazonia, 1,500 BC in Mesoamerica, and in the eastern United States, 2,500 BC. Villages were formed in the Fertile Crescent by 9,000 BC, by 7,500 BC in China, 3,000 BC in England, between 3,100 and 1,800 BC in the Andes, 6,000 BC in Amazonia, 1,500 BC in Mesoamerica, and 500 BC in the eastern United States. Chiefdoms were formed in the Fertile Crescent by 5,500 BC, in China by 4,000 BC, in England by 2,500 BC, in the Andes by 1,500 BC, in Amazonia by 1 AD, in Mesoamerica by 1,500 BC, and in the eastern United States by 200 BC. Widespread metal tools or artifacts, copper and or bronze, were adopted in the Fertile Crescent in 4,000 BC, in China by 2,000 BC, in England by 2,000 BC, in the Andes by 1,000 AD, and they were unknown in Amazonia, Mesoamerica, and the eastern United States. States were adopted in the Fertile Crescent in 3,700 BC, in China by 2,000 BC, in England by 500 AD, in the Andes by 1 AD. They were unknown in Amazonia, by 300 BC in Mesoamerica, and they were unknown in the eastern United States. Writing was adopted in the Fertile Crescent by 3,200 BC, by 1,300 BC in China, by 43 AD in England. It was unknown in the Andes and Amazonia, and it was known by 600 BC in Mesoamerica. And widespread iron tools were adopted in the Fertile Crescent in 900 BC, in China by 500 BC, in England by 650 BC, and they were unknown in the other areas. This table is sure to horrify any knowledgeable scholar because it reduces exceedingly complex histories to a few seemingly precise dates. In reality, all of those dates are merely attempts to label arbitrary points along a continuum. For example, more significant than the date of the first metal tool found by some archaeologist is the time when a significant fraction of all tools were made of metal. But how common must metal tools be to rate as widespread? Dates for the appearance of the same development may differ among different parts of the same homeland. For instance, within the Andean region, pottery appears about 1,300 years earlier in coastal Ecuador, 3,100 BC, than in Peru, 1,800 BC. Some dates, such as those for the rise of chiefdoms, are more difficult to infer from the archaeological record than are dates of artifacts like pottery or metal tools. Some of the dates in that table are very uncertain, especially those for the onset of American food production. Nevertheless, as long as one understands that the table is a simplification, it is useful for comparing continental histories. The table suggests that food production began to provide a large fraction of human diets around 5,000 years earlier in the Eurasian homelands than in those of the Americas. A caveat must be mentioned immediately. While there is no doubt about the antiquity of food production in Eurasia, there is controversy about its onset in the Americas. In particular, archaeologists often cite considerably older claimed dates for domesticated plants at Coxcatlan Cave in Mexico and Guitarero Cave in Peru, and at some other American sites than the dates given in the table. Those claims are now being reevaluated for several reasons. Recent direct radiocarbon dating of crop remains themselves has in some cases been yielding younger dates. The older dates previously reported were based instead on charcoal thought to be contemporaneous with the plant remains, but possibly not so. And the status of some of the older plant remains as crops, or just as collected wild plants, is uncertain. Still, even if plant domestication did begin earlier in the Americas than the dates shown, Agriculture surely did not provide the basis for most human calorie intake and sedentary existence in American homelands until much later than in Eurasian homelands. As we saw in chapters 5 and 10, only a few relatively small areas of each hemisphere acted as a homeland where food production first arose, and from which it then spread. Those homelands were the Fertile Crescent and China in Eurasia, and the Andes and Amazonia, Mesoamerica, and the eastern United States in the Americas. The rate of spread of key developments is especially well understood for Europe, thanks to the many archaeologists at work there. Once food